for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Iran announced it produced higher enriched uranium and took measures against protesters on the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. European leaders pledged to support Greece through its debt crisis, but said financial support is not necessary now, and U.S. and Afghan troops prepare for what's being described as the biggest offensive against the Taliban in the 9-year war. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday news roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Nadia Bilbasi of Middle East Broadcast Center, and Martin Walker of United Press International. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you all in the midst of this blizzard we've had. It's good that you all got out. David, tell us what's happening in Greece and why it's so important to the rest of the European Union.
Greece is facing a debt crisis, but what we're really looking at is a crisis for the European Union as a whole. The European Union is a funny hybrid. It's got one currency, the euro. It's got one central bank, the European Central Bank, but it has 27 separate finance ministries, each of them pursuing their own policies. Greece has pursued, some would argue, a somewhat reckless policy of public debt and private debt. And investors increasingly over the last year have been betting on the possibility that Greek banks and indeed Greece itself could default, so that the spreads between what Greece pays to borrow in euros to finance public and private projects and what other European countries pay has been widening and widening as investors bet that this was unsustainable. And this has finally begun to come crashing down the last few weeks. The European Union has announced that it's prepared to stand by Greece, come
stand
to its defense.
By.
Well, I mean, precisely, it's a very vague statement.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
And investors, of course, always looking for weakness, probing, have been pushing at this. And a lot of people think that this crisis fundamentally shows that the things that were left out of the European project, that unless you have some commonality of fiscal policy, the single monetary policy in the end is prone to the kinds of stresses we've been seeing.
Martin, will the EU eventually be forced to bail out Greece?
Well, one of the problems is that, as David said, the EU is a hybrid, and there are more members of the more of the 27 member states are not in the eurozone than are in the eurozone, and so big economies like Britain, for example, are not directly influenced by this. Although British banks have probably got something like $50 billion worth of exposure to Greek banks. The real difficulty is here that as far as the markets are concerned, Greece and the rest of Europe are married fiscally. And they've always assumed that the Germans and the other stronger currencies would come to bail out the Greeks. However, when the Germans went into the euro back in the 1990s, the deal was, the promise was, this would never happen. Thrifty German taxpayers would never have to bail out the profligate Greeks. And it's not just the Greeks who've got a over 12% budget deficit this year. Initially, they said it was 6%, but they've lied through their teeth about this. It's also the Portuguese, it's the Greeks, it's the Italians. And since it's P-I-G-S, they go by the unfortunate acronym, as you can imagine. Now, the difficulty is here is that European banks, French and German, have each got about $250 billion worth of exposure to the banks in those countries. The Netherlands have got about $100 billion exposure. In other words, we're going to have a whole new European banking crisis if there is a debt crisis that is not resolved and Greece has to default. So, in other words, people are going to have to spend more money now to try and bail out Greece than they would lose, because they would lose more later if they don't.
David.
If listeners have been wondering why U.S. financial markets have been falling out of bed over the last week.
And falling, indeed, today.
Today is a little different. It really involves China more than Europe. But the fear about Europe is that Greece could be a kind of Lehman Brothers, that Greece's overexposure, its over-indebtedness, could produce a kind of run that would ripple through the banking sector. As Martin was saying, you have heavy exposure. French banks have something like $80 billion in lending to Greece and Greek institutions. And so there's this fear that if there isn't a bailout, as was the case with Lehman, you remember that the Bush administration let Lehman Brothers go down, and then pow, the dominoes began to fall. And there's a fear that since there isn't a real rescue plan that's been announced, they're creeping closer and closer to this Lehman Brothers-like situation. That's what's got the market spooked.
So what happens to Great Britain in the meantime, which is not part of the euro?
Well, because Great Britain didn't join the euro, it's allowed to devalue. Because the real problem that Greece and these other weaker economies in the Eurozone have got is that they have surrendered their national sovereignty over interest rates, over money supply, to the European Central Bank. They can't devalue, which is the normal way out of this kind of crisis. The British have been able to do so, which is why some of the markets seem to be thinking that the British economy is going to do rather better than the European one over the next couple of years. That remains to be seen. But the problem here is that the European Central Bank's policy has been run in order to benefit its strongest member, Germany. Moreover, the Germans have done a wonderful job in self-discipline. They have cut real wages over the past 10 years. They've become much more competitive. They've become one of the world's, the world's number two biggest exporter. And what that meant was that countries that couldn't devalue, like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Italy, Spain, have become woefully uncompetitive within the Eurozone. So unit labor costs in Greece are probably about 30% higher than they are in Germany.
Martin Malker of UPI, Nadia Bilbasi, senior correspondent for Middle East Broadcast Center, David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post, co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Nadia, let's turn to Iran and President Ahmadinejad declaring Iran a nuclear state. What does that mean?
I think he was trying to have a message to the domestic audience and to the international audience that in the considering the situation of a terrible internal struggle, and Iran has changed its face after the election of June 11th, the only thing they can hold on and give him legitimacy is the nuclear file. And therefore, he wanted to tell the whole world that we are able now to enrich 20% of the uranium that we have. But many people don't believe him, including this administration, to the degree that the spokesman of the White House, Robert Gibbs, said that he's talking politics and not physics. And also there was some internal report in the UN that basically said that the amount that they enrich is very modest and it's not enough to produce a warhead. And therefore, I think for him it was as a message of distraction from everybody who was focusing on the internal situation, on the protest, on, as we expected, the opposition, including the two major leaders of Karoubi and Mousavi, will be there in central stage. So for him, he wanted to take the country back and to say to the region as well, to the Arab countries in the region, I'm the one in control. Look at me. It's a message control more than anything else.
David.
Well, I think Nadia summed it up well. What a spectacle yesterday, celebrating the 31st anniversary of this Islamic revolution. And what did we see? We saw a police state suppressing its own citizens in the streets. They were fairly successful, as police states often are, and the demonstrations were small, and two of the presidential candidates from last June appear to have been physically prevented from joining the demonstrations. Meanwhile, the ruling clique, we speak of a kind of coup that's been executed by the Revolutionary Guard and its supporters to back President Ahmadinejad and his small group. That group sits on top of this very society in turmoil, talking about acquiring nuclear weapons. Ahmadinejad was saying yesterday, we are now prepared to move from low-enriched uranium, the 5% level that they've been building up, to enrichment levels of 20%, which you could use for medical isotopes, but then beyond that to 80, 90%, which would allow you to make a nuclear weapon. It's scary stuff in some ways because of what an unstable country Iran has become.
Martin, were you at all surprised by the turnout or the reaction of the government? They were using paint bombs to target those individuals. Who knows what's going to happen to them afterwards?
Well, not just paint bombs, which is a trick the Chinese developed to be able to identify people who've been demonstrating later. They were also using tear gas inside the underground, the metro stations, which is a dangerous, possibly lethal thing to do. They were certainly firing into the air. I got messages from people inside Iran that came out through torturous routes, claiming that there'd been some shooting directly into the crowd. The difficulty is that, of course, when a government which has not lost its nerve and which can pay the police, which can pay the security forces, when it's determined to put on a show of force, it normally can succeed.
Do you expect sanctions ahead from the U.S. joining with, or do you expect China to continue to bulk?
Well, China gets 15% of its oil from Iran. My guess is that China does not want to be totally isolated, and so China might well abstain. Certainly, the Russians, and I was in Moscow recently, seem to have seen the light about Iran. But best bear one thing in mind, which is that the IAEA's own reports, that's the Atomic Energy Watchdog, who've still got the rights to inspect, they reckon that over a third of the 3,000-plus centrifuges that Iran uses to concentrate its uranium are now out of action, and that they're having real problem with fulfilling the boast of Ahmadinejad.
Martin Walker, foreign affairs writer for United Press International. Short break, and we'll come back with your calls and email. Go back to our discussion on Iran with an email from Charlie in Martha's Vineyard, who says, please ask what Iran's opposition movement actually stands for. David.
It's a good question, in part because of the vagueness of its position on the issue that we care most about, which is the nuclear question. The Iranian opposition seems to support continuing ahead with a nuclear program, just as Ahmadinejad is. I think the fair thing to say about this movement is that it is a broad coalition. It includes people who were instrumental in creating the revolution. Mousavi was the first Iranian prime minister. Mehdi Karoubi, another very courageous opposition candidate, has
but
been part of the...
But would they be going, for example, for a secular government, Nadia?
I don't know if they're going to go for a secular government. I mean, let's remember that the reason they were formed in the beginning was to dispute the election of Ahmadinejad. And they thought that his election was illegitimate, and therefore every kind of different party joined together for this purpose. But ultimately, I don't even think that the nuclear issue will be dealt will be probably slightly dealt differently, but I think there is an interest in Iran that they will go nuclear, considering the region. The other thing is, I don't know if they're going to go secular, because obviously many people think they wanted a democracy, but it's not going to be a Western-style democracy. It's going to be something different than what you have now, but definitely not a Western European style.
And what about the Green Movement in Iran, Martin?
Well, it's a pretty unlikely coalition in that many of its apparent leaders or figureheads are people who really want to reform the existing religious-style autocracy, whereas an increasing number, certainly of the young, of the students, have become much more militant and want to change the regime altogether. That's pretty clear. Now, in the past, what seemed to be the case with the opposition was that it was mainly a middle-class, educated, even upper-class phenomenon. But what was really striking late last year was the way in which lower-class, working-class, peasant people, particularly in Qom, in the big riots that took place there, showed that they were quite ready to join in with the opposition here. And that must have been really terrifying for the Iranian government. And the reason for that is quite simple. It's not just a crisis here of politics. It's also an economic crisis.
All right, and let's go back, David, to this question of Iran's nuclear ambitions and what the Obama administration can do to win over support for sanctions.
Well, the Obama administration has continued to, you could say, straddle policy. President Obama last Tuesday in a brief press conference gave a perfect example of this. He said that we're now going for a strong regime of sanctions, and that's on the table for the next several months at the UN. But at the same time, he said the door is still open. If Iran wants to meet international norms, wants to join in an acceptable framework, we would welcome that. The White House believes that kind of statement is itself, in a weird way, a kind of pressure on Iran. Iran loves to have the great Satan, you know, a very strident America as its enemy, as a rallying point. And Obama has not given them that. It's very deliberate. And so I think that if policy seems a little muddled when we look at it, to some extent, that's by design, to avoid giving the Iranian regime an easy American target.
And, of course, Secretary of State Clinton, after stopping to see her husband, Bill Clinton, just released to the hospital, from the hospital, going to the Middle East, Nadia.
Yes, absolutely.
Going to make a speech on Sunday. Is Iran basically the focus there?
Yes, she's going to Qatar, she's going to Saudi Arabia. I think now the administration is looking into implementing sanctions, not just the individual that we have seen from the U.S. by the Treasury Department the day before yesterday, but also they wanted a U.N. sanction and to have the Arab countries on board so that she has to go and to talk to the Saudis. Now, as you know, people in the region are very scared of Iran. They don't talk about it publicly, but everybody knows that. So you want to exchange ideas with them. What will be the most effective way of doing it? Of course, the military strike has always been put on the table, and now there's fear that the Israelis might use it. But the Gulf countries obviously are very worried about that, and they don't want to use that. So despite everything, I think the options in front of the administration are limited in terms of what they can do with Iran. They're still defiant, although Ahmadinejad was saying yesterday, look, we're enriching 20% of the uranium, but we're not going to produce a bomb. If we do, we will be telling you. Mm. I mean, who's to trust here? But the bottom line is the options are very limited, and I think she wants to make sure that the Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia, is on board with every American move.
And Martin, what about the American hikers still being held by the Iranians?
Well, whenever they can grab a piece of diplomatic traction, they will certainly use it. And I mean, I think that the way in which Iran has tried to use hostages in the past, where the British sailors who were claimed to be in Iranian waters,
but haven't they said they'd be open to a trade?
They have indeed said they'd be open to a trade, but that in effect reinforces the Iranian claim that this is an espionage issue, because it's espionage trade rather than releasing innocent
civilians.
These
poor people have been held since July.
Well, but there's been more people in North Korea who've been even longer held. But one point is worth adding to what Nadia was saying about how much of the Arab world is really appalled at Iranian nuclear ambitions. There was an extraordinary front page piece in one of the main Egyptian papers this week, a glowing profile of the head of Mossad, Israeli intelligence, suggesting that one reason why the Iranian bomb was not proceeding as fast as expected was because of his success in managing to slow down and derail things. This is an extraordinary development that Mossad gets praised. Do you agree, Nadia?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to praise the enemy by itself is definitely a statement. And I think by itself, it shows that not just Egypt and Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region, because the last thing they want to see is a nuclear Iran. Now, are we close to it or not? I'm not really sure.
A nuclear Shia Iran.
The Washington Post published a fascinating article this week, speculating, I think is the right word, about the possibility that sabotage by Israel, by the United States — it didn't specify who the sabotage might have been done by — might be responsible for this very interesting sluggishness in Iran's ability to make its centrifuges work. I mean, for all these announcements from Ahmadinejad that we're a nuclear power, we're pushing ahead, the fact is, if you look at the statistics, that they're going a lot slower than people expected.
Yeah.
Why? Why do their centrifuges keep breaking down? Why is the output, despite the additional number of centrifuges, pretty much steady? And people are looking at that, and I think in Egypt, yeah, this profile may be written on the assumption that the Israelis somehow are sneaking a gremlin into the works, so that's part of what's going on.
Not just the Israelis. I mean, there's been speculation in Britain about the way in which MI6 has allegedly been managing to poison the wells of international black market trafficking in the technology and putting in deliberately false and poisoned pieces of kit that Iranians are buying on the black market.
There is no peace in the world right now. Let's talk about the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. How reliable, first, David, is the information that the leader of the Pakistani Taliban is actually dead?
My sources in the U.S. government have told me for the last several weeks that they believe, that they're confident, that the leader of the Pakistani Taliban,
Hakim Abdullah,
Why is
there such confusion about it?
Well, because the Taliban continues to deny it. I think a more decisive verdict here, still not 100%, came from Pakistani government sources who said this week, yes, we believe it's so. We are now confident that Hakimullah Massoud, the leader of the Taliban, is dead. What we do know, putting aside this question of sort of final death certificate for Hakimullah, is that over the last month, the United States has launched a barrage of predator strikes on Taliban targets, mostly in North Waziristan. It's at a level of intensity that we've never seen. Now, you could argue that this is really in retaliation for the death of 8 CIA officers in the base in Khost, just across the border in Afghanistan, who were involved in selecting targets. But on one day, for example, we had at least 17 Hellfire missiles fired from Predators in North Waziristan. I mean, it's often you go a week with only one missile being fired. So they have had people in their sights. There's been a lot of speculation that they may have been going after very high-level Al-Qaeda targets as well.
But, you know, the question becomes, all right, you take down one Taliban leader, don't six others spring up? I mean, how broad can this attack be? How effective can it be in taking them down?
I think then also the confusion comes from the fact that every time the Pakistani intelligence services or the U.S. claims that Hakimullah Massoud is dead, he shows up again. And we have seen him last time in this video, joint video with the agent, the Jordanian agent who killed the CIA officers in Afghanistan and Hammam el-Bloui. Now, the thing about this guy is he's very charismatic and he is very skillful in how he deals with the media even, and he is very articulate of what vision he has for Pakistan. Now, if they manage to kill him, and we don't know if it's 100% sure, but there is some talks that actually this is a tactic on behalf of the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, that they will give themselves time so there won't be a power struggle, and they will choose an eventual successor. And there is actually three names of who could take his place. But I think it will weaken them, but it's not going to destroy them, because considering that they have lost their base after the Pakistani army launched an attack in Waziristan, and now if he is dead and he's considered a very effective commander, definitely it will weaken them. And don't forget that he was in charge of so many spectacular suicide attacks, and he claiming, even with added to his prestige, that he controlled at one stage a police station holding 300 Pakistani soldiers. Now, if somebody else come and take his place, it will show that, and I think they will carry some suicide attack, not to the same standard, but they will want it to prove that they are there, They're not going to disappear.
And Martin, talk about the U.S., NATO, and Afghan troops surrounding the Taliban stronghold in the Helmand province. You've got civilians who are fleeing that area. You've got leaders begging the U.S. and others to try to avoid civilians. How can they possibly avoid civilians?
Well, they can't. And the Pakistani foreign minister said recently that one result of these airstrikes that David was talking about was over 500 civilian dead. And I think it's interesting that this Operation Mushtarak, which means togetherness in Dari, is taking place right now when we've had this spate of hellfire drone attacks. And it's clear that this is building up as a pretty decisive kind of battle. There's something like 12 to 15,000 troops, including 4,000 Brits, about 8,000 to 9,000 Americans, 2,500 Afghans, surrounding now the town of Marja, which has been a real kernel of a real center and focus of Taliban operations.
But is the objective to get these Taliban to cross over and join the government, David?
In the long run, yes. I was in the area of Marja in Helmand province twice last year, and what you saw there was that in the areas where U.S. Marines came in force last year, there was some surprising changes. Two districts that they love to show off to reporters. So there's a bit of theater here, to be honest. Garmsir and Nawa are the names of these two districts. But Marja sat in the middle of this array of U.S. forces, driving the military commanders crazy. They don't like to have that pocket of insecurity, so they've been determined to go after it. They thought that the Taliban, which had been using this area as a safe haven, would stand and fight. Increasingly in the last week, it seemed like they're doing everything they can to get them to flee so as to reduce the level of violence, the number of civilian casualties.
David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now. 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Amelia Island, Florida. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for your economics person there that did a great job of explaining the euro mess in a relatively quick period of time. It's the best articulated I've ever heard. My question is about China. And on the financial press over the last couple of weeks, they have tried to explain what the Chinese central bank is trying to do by saying that they're trying to gradually get control of their situation. And I'm sure that's the case. But since they've raised the reserve requirement twice, isn't raising the reserve requirement in economics the one of the harshest things you can possibly do to try to cut back on lending?
David,
it is harsh. It's a way, really, of just taking money out of the hands of the commercial banks so that they can't lend it. They have to park it with the central bank. That's what the Chinese have announced. The more normal thing that you do would be to raise interest rates to make it harder for people to borrow. They borrow less, and then the economy cools down. What's interesting about what China's doing now is that it is seeking to address the problem of the bubble economy in China that worries a lot of people. And, you know, there's some shocks from that today in our markets. But you know what? It's a lot better to have that, you know, gradual systematic policy effort than to have the bubble burst.
So why is our stock market diving? Because China has just raised its reserve requirement, Martin.
Well, because 60% of all of Chinese exports come from companies that are either wholly or partly owned by foreigners, including Americans. And also, if China is going to restrain its demand and cut back its demand, that means that commodity prices worldwide will be going down. There'll be less upward pressure upon commodity prices. But the real fact here is that the Chinese have done a bigger amount of stimulus than any other country in the world. $586 billion last year in stimulus spending, deficit spending, if you like, but by far the biggest was Beijing in December of 2008 told its commercial banks to lend. And by golly, they lent like never before. They lent a total last year of $1.4 trillion.
To whom?
To Chinese borrowers. That is a third of GDP. We have never before, ever, in any country seen commercial banks lend a third of GDP in 1 year. They carried on lending again this January, even though Beijing was saying, whoa, try and back this down. So that is why they've now taken a sledgehammer to try and stop this. They're now, the capital reserve requirements for big Chinese banks are now 16%. That's an enormous take.
Mark Malker, David Ignatius, and Nadia Bilbasi. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Number of you are asking, where has Haiti gone from the news? Well, it hasn't gone from here. It was the next subject on my list. Our emailer, Dave, who's in Mason, Ohio, recalls there have been more than 230,000 killed. Today is National Day of Mourning. The rainy season is about to begin. 750,000 are homeless. There is about to be a huge mud hole with people trying to live in it. The river is now an open sewer and still a source of water. Nadia, you were just there.
I was there. I spent a week there, and it's devastating. And what I couldn't understand is beyond my comprehension is all this goodwill from the international community. We're talking about $630 million. spent about the United Nations, raising $531 million. But the money did not go to the people. I mean, I stayed, to be honest, from the airport where all the journalists were and all the money and the aids and organizations were based. And I attached myself to a local NGO. And I've been day in and day out to this, what they call the squalid cities, which is basically 800,000 people living under nothing. They have like corrugated iron, they have plastic sheetings, and they have nothing. All this money has not trickled to the people who need it.
Why not?
I think there is bad organizations. There is bureaucracy on behalf of the UN. Everybody wanted to show that they're distributing here and there, but there is no coordination between them. So therefore, the money didn't go to the right people. And I don't know why till now, and we're talking about a month after the earthquake, we're talking about all these people who, as you said, they're going to face even more hardship, considering that the rainy season is about to happen. Mm. We're talking about hurricane season as well. And the problem, like in comparison to the tsunamis, for example, people were able to be moved out of the city. Most of these people are still in Port-au-Prince and unable to move. So we're talking about a massive movement of people, especially at night. And as you said, using the river as a public sewage, they have no access to anything. Medical facilities were very limited. Most people have to face amputated legs and arms, and it shouldn't be this way. Infection, diseases that is going to happen because of the bad sanitation, etc. And I think, I don't know what is the problem. I really wanted to hold somebody accountable for it, because the money is there, the goodwill is there. People were desperate and very sympathetic with Haiti, but yet the people did not see the benefit of this money.
David.
Nadia's description is so powerful. The only thing I can add from what I've been reading and hearing is that aid organizations, the U.S. military, to the extent it's been involved in relief work, have been worried that simply putting supplies out there opens the way for plunder. So often, because you don't have the basics of social organization left, or to some extent they weren't there in the beginning, it's just very difficult to have orderly distribution. These NGOs, in my experience, insist on that. They worry that adding to chaos by making money and supplies available in a disorderly way is the worst thing they can do. But I think Nadia's picture is so vivid. It ought to haunt us all. And as Nadia says, we should demand accountability.
It breaks your heart, Martin.
Well, it really does, and it's going to break our hearts a bit further when, as I suspect, we're going to have an outbreak of cholera because of the extraordinarily bad hygienic conditions. There was a report on NPR today about one particular of these refugee camps, and there's over a million people still sleeping out in one of these refugee camps with 900 families and four foul, overflowing porta cabins. So people are using the river, they're using fields. The result is going to be, I think, a wave of cholera unless we can get ahead of this problem very fast.
Well, how would you get ahead of it at this point? What would be the first step that some country like the United States would take?
I think the most important thing is to move these people out of these camps or the whatever you call them, collective cities. Many people have relatives in the countryside. They can attach these people to a relative outside of Port-au-Prince because most of the damage has happened there and surrounding areas. The problem is you have to organize these people. There is a security problem, and I acknowledge that, and people are really scared. I mean, when I was there with the local NGO, I mean, one of these people are armed for us to be there with doctors to check people and to see what could happen. So I understand, but it didn't go out of proportion like we expect looting and complete chaos. It didn't actually happen. So what you need is you need somebody who will be able to go to these centers and find some local leaders. I know that the government collapsed. I know that the NGOs and the country doesn't have the infrastructure because in the good days it was plagued by military coups, by corruption. 60% of the budget of the government comes from foreign aid, completely dependent on the outside world. Now, this administration is talking about this interim recovery plan. They're talking about involving the prime minister. They're talking about figures like President Clinton. Hopefully, he'll be back soon after his ordeal in the hospital. But saying that, I think they need the international community to keep a watchful eye, and they need some kind of a working system on the ground, because that's the problem.
Here's another email from Dito in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I couldn't go because of the storm, so I'll hope to go in early March. Does the relief effort in Haiti hold any opportunities for the U.S. and Cuba to improve relations? We've heard about overflight rights for U.S. military aircraft and Cuban troops in Haiti helping with relief efforts. Since we find ourselves working with Cuba in Haiti, couldn't this open a door for a diplomatic exchange?
It's a fascinating suggestion. It would since Florida is going to bear the brunt of the sort of overflow of the Haiti tragedy, the political implications in Florida are something that Obama would think through. But that's not going to really solve or even address in a decisive way the question that we're talking about, the breakdown of a country, 10 million people in just these absolutely horrific, ruinous conditions. As we were talking, I was thinking of the old concept of United Nations trusteeship, something like that, in which there is a decisive international intervention. I think the idea that the U.S. should do this is wrong. I think we need to do it in partnership with other countries. It'd be nice if Cuba was one of them. But a trusteeship where the institutions that will help Haiti not just recover from this earthquake, but help it become a prosperous modern country can be built from the ground up. It seems to me that's what people need to think
all
about.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Kathleen, who's in Golden, Colorado. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Over the last 6 years, I've heard a lot of media hosts and on TV and on radio allow the unsubstantiated claim that Iran already has a nuclear weapons program instead of using the word alleged. I don't hear any of the hosts challenging people who repeat that unsubstantiated claim and to require the word alleged be put in front of that statement. And I also wanted to ask your guest, Ahmadinejad just announced that they went from 3.5% to 20%. According to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, how much are they allowed? What level, what percentage are they allowed to enrich uranium?
The treaty is not specific on any particular amount, so long as the other norms are observed, and that includes abiding by not just the first rendition of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but also the latest protocols. I think it's the point the caller makes is very important. What we've all been quite careful to say, all three of us here, I note, was we never talked about Iran's nuclear weapons program. We talked about Iran's nuclear program, which maintains a certain degree of ambiguity. I think we all learned during the Iraq case of weapons of mass destruction just how dangerous it could be not to be quite precise about this.
David.
I think that's right. I think one way that the Obama administration has thought about responding to the nuclear problem with Iran is to say, okay, You claim that you have no desire to build a nuclear weapon. So you need, because there are international doubts, there are four UN resolutions noting Iran's violation of existing IAEA protocols and standards, you need to help us figure out a way to verify that what you claim is in fact the case.
All right, let's take it in another direction. Some people have argued that should Iran actually develop nuclear weapons, it could stabilize the area. What's your reaction, Nadia?
I don't think that that will be the case, actually, because that will trigger a nuclear race. Because if Iran has it, why can't Saudi Arabia or Egypt have it? And therefore, I don't think the argument really valid in terms of allowing them. I know some people said we can live with nuclear Iran. And when you point out to other countries who develop it without an international consent or approval, and they did it by themselves, and they become a nuclear weapons, like the nuclear weapons countries like Pakistan, India,
like
Israel. South Africa at one stage, etc. So the bottom line is, I think the whole world wanted to stay away from having a weapon on mass destruction on the level of nuclear weapons. So therefore, it's their interest of everybody to decrease it and not to allow one country to have it so other countries can compete with it. So it used to be a weapon of deterrence, but now I don't think, there's worries that these unstable regimes Who knows? I mean, I don't know if a democracy, you can trust a democracy with nuclear weapons and you don't trust others, basically. I mean, some argument can also play into that direction, but I think it's a false argument.
All right. To Natalie in Wichita Falls, Texas. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Hello. Yes, I have a comment about Iran and then a quick question about Haiti. My comment, I think that we should probably at times take what the leader of Iran, Ahmadinejad, says with a grain of salt on here. Besides, when things are translated, okay, to the English-speaking nations, sometimes things can be turned around, okay, on that. So we should give that some thought. And I might as well make, an analogy with, let's say, passages from the Bible. If we were to take literally what has been said in the Bible, we might be very surprised about the severity of some of the suggestions in the Bible, especially the Old Testament.
All right.
Okay. So that's my comment there.
Okay.
And then the question about Haiti. Could somebody on the panel? Perhaps Martin there, he might know, how is the cost being covered for the victims coming to and fro Florida?
All right. Thanks for your call. Let's take the second part of that first. We know that many victims of the earthquake have been sent to Florida hospitals. How are those costs being covered? And an additional question, will they be sent back to Haiti, Martin?
Well, there's ambiguity about whether or not they're going to be sent back. And this, as David said earlier, is starting to become a political issue down in Florida. But on the question of the cost, there's just simply no shortage of money here. The UN's got close to 600, I think it's 600 billion. Something like 50 billion's come in on mobile phone charges alone. But so far, there hasn't the Florida hospitals have not been charging for the kind of emergency work that they've been doing. And the huge amount of Médecins Sans Frontières and other NGOs who've gone into Haiti means, as we heard earlier, there's simply no shortage of medical skill. It's a matter of organizing and getting them to the right, to people who need it.
Martin Walker of UPI, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Waldorf, Maryland. Darnell, thanks for joining us.
Hi. I hope the situation in Iran does not turn out like the situation in Iraq. The United States needs to go slow. They need to make sure their intelligence is correct. And I just don't want them to do the same thing they did with Saddam Hussein, because we all see how that turned out. As far as Haiti, I am wondering why are they building all these tent cities when that place is known for hurricanes. I'm a construction worker, and we use sea cans. I'm sure you guys all know what sea cans are. Those things can be stacked on top of each other and can be fortified to make temporary shelter through the hurricane season. And I'd like to know what your panel thinks about that.
All right. Thanks for calling. Go slow on Iran, David.
Well, I think the caller makes the right point, and it's one that I think is clearly understood by this administration. They have moved carefully. They have tried to keep the door open for negotiations, even as the Iranians have essentially spurned their efforts. And perhaps most important, they have talked strenuously with the Israeli government about what they view as the importance of not having any precipitous military strike by Israel against Iran. And that I'm told that those talks have been quite effective.
And I do hope that there is the opportunity to find better shelter for those in Haiti, like the sea cans that our caller talks about. I just want to get in a word about Nelson Mandela, mm-hmm. who was released from prison 20 years ago.
Oh, I remember this day. I was in London as a student, and actually I was part of the campaign of boycotting South African products during apartheid time. And I remember the day that Mandela was released, and it was the first time the whole world looked at him and realized he looked so different from the pictures we had of this during his trial, of a very sturdy jet black hair lawyer, and now we see this frail man, but he came out with this vision for South Africa. He came out talking about building a rainbow nation, his hands with Winnie Mandela at the time, and I think we have to credit a man like Mandela for this transition from could be a bloody path, actually, could be a civil war, but he took them from apartheid, one of the worst probably discriminatory system in the world, to a multiracial democracy. And he decided he's not going to stay. He served 5 years and he stepped down. And he's a man that we have, we wish that we have so many like Mandela's all over the world. I think we have less conflict.
He looked so well yesterday when we saw the pictures on television at 92 years old,
almost
smiling, and I hope in good health. Thank you all so much, Nadia Bilbasi. She's senior U.S. correspondent for Middle East Broadcast Center, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, Martin Walker of UPI. Have a great weekend, everybody. Stay safe and try not to fall. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.